March 24th, 2024. And in just over a week, some of you will be leaving, some will be staying. Winter retreat coming to an end, and this is considered a long retreat, 3 months. So I'm really impressed with the retreat crew. It's a very big crew, and nobody pulled a runner, and it's almost unheard of for a crew this big. And sadhu, anumodana. So it's good that you all learn to work together. I know it hasn't always been easy. And as it's said, the kitchen is the monastery hell realm. So you have to be doing earth store bodhisattva practice to abide in the kitchen. So it's like they say, the jizo bodhisattva goes into hell to save living beings. So you have to go into hell to feed the community. But it's very nice that we've been looked after, and come April 1st, then the monastic community will start looking after things again, looking after the monastery. It's great for us, though, great opportunity to be able to be on retreat and really dive headfirst into the practice. And also, we've had our retreats within the retreat, so each of the monastics has gotten 2 weeks of retreat, and I was just in this last slot, so I was very grateful to have that time. And I decided to capitalize on the sunny weather that we had for a little while. So first few days of my retreat, it was raining still. But then as soon as the sun came out, I went out to a campsite that a few people have been staying at in recent years that we've been developing. It's a very spacious and yet very secluded campsite. And it was just really wonderful to be out there and taking my meals out there, and wasn't sleeping there at first. I wasn't spending the nights there. But then I was going for the whole days. I'd sleep in my kuti and then go for the day at this campsite. And then eventually I just started staying out at the campsite. And really good to be out in nature. And there are difficulties. There's lessons to be learned staying out in nature. And I always find these very, very valuable. One is just, it makes me feel like a forest monk, being out in the forest, living under the trees. And this particular site, there's these very tall Doug fir trees, and the way they're, the canopy is just, it gives a sense of vastness and spaciousness, but also seclusion. And it's it was a very interesting view across the valley. And having the sun, the mornings were quite cold. So I had one of my first forest monk experiences in a while, which was waking up at midnight shivering because it was quite cold the first couple nights, and I didn't have a sufficient sleeping bag. I was using this ultralight sleeping bag that only goes up to like my chest, and so was shivering and was too cold. So then end up curled up in the fetal position, trying to get as warm as possible. But then adjusting, adapting, learning how to be more comfortable while in the forest. And then the sun came out, so not only does the sun allow me to go to a campsite, but allows the ants to come out from underground. So the ants were also happy about the sun, and many, many ants came out and started establishing trails. There's this one type of ant, I don't know what it's called, but I call them oak ants, because they live in oak trees and Doug fir trees, and the back of their body is kind of a oak color. It's kind of grayish with black streaks, and they bite. I don't know if they're poisonous, but they pinch their bite. When they bite, they pinch really hard. And so these particular ants were establishing trails, and I had a kind of a largish mat set out where I was taking my meal and doing some sitting, and had my things laid out. And when I was doing walking meditation one of the first sunny days, these ants established a trail across this mat. So then they, when I went back to the mat was just, there was a river of ants crossing this mat. And so I picked the mat up and tried to shake them off. They kind of cling to it and stick to it, and hung the mat up and took a soft broom and tried to broom them off. And but then they just, they kept going on that same trail in the dirt where the mat was. So they had a well, they had created a well-established trail. And then once they create a trail, they'll just do that same trail every day. That's one thing, living out in the forest, you learn about ants and how they establish trails. And it's even in our precepts in the Vinaya that a wilderness-dwelling monk is supposed to know which types of ants and termites live at which trees and where is an appropriate place to sit and not to sit under trees that drop sap. This is all in the Vinaya. And so the next day, I had the mat hanging up, so I put the mat back down, but I put it back in the same spot. Instead of avoiding the ant where the ant trail was, I had put it back in the same spot. But I had thought, well, the day before they established their trail about 4 p.m., so I've got plenty of time. But it was a bit hotter, so I was having my meal, and I was about one quarter of the way through my meal, and I looked to my left, and these ants, the river of ants had arrived and was halfway up my body, almost at my neck. So there was hundreds and hundreds of ants on my robe. These ants that I know they bite, they're kind of painful when they bite. And there was just this river of them, but I was in their trail, so they were just trying to go over me and stay on their same trail that they'd already established. They had that line, and they were just going to go over me. So I was kind of, what do I do? And I was actually feeling quite peaceful, though, at the sight, and these ants coming over me, I didn't really get too bothered by them. I thought about it afterwards. I could have gotten up and just run and panicked or something, but I was feeling quite at ease with these ants, and I just took my face cloth, and I started batting at them a little bit, and then they turned around and they went down, and they went off of me, and they just went back, and then they established another trail around the mat, and it's okay. That was nice, and not a single one bit me. Actually, the whole time I was there, I didn't get bit by a single ant. So I felt, and then the next day, I just thought, okay, well, I should move the mat. I shouldn't put the mat right there because the ants established their trail. It's not that they're everywhere all over the ground, but they have these trails and you just avoid them and you can coexist quite peacefully with them. So I was really grateful to be retaught these lessons of the forest, and it just felt very, very good being out there. And then just having not much to do except have the meal and make a cup of coffee afterwards, and then just sit in the perfect weather with the sun, and found that quite rejuvenating for me and quite useful. So we develop these different qualities when we come to practice. And for the winter retreat crew, you've been developing qualities of generosity, kindness, and patience. And these three qualities will help all of us to be able to live together and live together harmoniously, not be at each other's throats. So we use these qualities of kindness, generosity, and patience. And these are Dhamma qualities, which really allow us to abide together, live together, and live happily together, have a sense of ease, whether we're in a group or we're on our own. If we've developed these three qualities of generosity, kindness, and patience, then when we're on our own, if we've exchanged kind words with others, not harsh words, but we've been kind in our speech and kind in our actions, then we go off to practice on our own and we don't really have to think about it or consider it. The mind can then calm down when we go into solitude and we're on our own. We don't have to rehash any difficult or irritating situations or things that we weren't happy about that didn't go our way. Pretty easy just to drop it. Actually, it's not easy to drop it. But at least we can start to see when the mind is stuck and where the mind is stuck. So when we come to the practice, for all of us, we want freedom, we want happiness, we want liberation, and yet the mind is stuck somewhere. So we need to acknowledge that the mind is stuck and start to try to see where is it stuck and how is it getting stuck? Why is it getting stuck? What's keeping it from happiness, from liberation, from freedom? And we can maybe start to see this when we're meditating in the hall, but the practice isn't always happening when we're meditating. The practice is also happening when we're interacting with each other, when we're walking around, times when we're not necessarily applying a meditation technique or holding our mind in a state of meditation, going about our duties in the monastery. This is really, a lot of the training occurs there as well. Where do we get irritated? Where do we get stuck? Where do we feel that sense of self-righteousness come up? Where do we experience conceit? Where do we feel like we want to assert ourselves or change things or assert our views? Those are the very things that are keeping us from freedom. Those are the very things that are keeping us from liberation. Those are the very things that are keeping us from purity. Because conceit is not a state of purity. Being really self-righteous and wanting to assert the way we want things is not a state of purity. When I think of Lungpa Cha, there's been these lovely readings happening of Lungpa Cha. And on this retreat in the forest, I recollected and thought about Lungpa Cha quite a bit. And even though I never had the opportunity to meet Lungpa Cha in person or pay respects to Lungpa Cha in person, when I think about Lungpa Cha, I just get this feeling of incredible purity. Just an incredible purity of body, speech, and mind, incredible, powerful purity of purpose, and purity of intention, no ulterior motive at all, just pure compassion, just wanting to help, just wanting to see others get to that same purity. And so you have these no-nonsense teachings of Lungpa Cha, because Lungpa Cha is one of those rare beings in the world who not only had that level of purity, but also was willing to reveal difficult truths to others in order to help them along on that path to purity. So the path to purity is difficult. It's going to entail that we really see where we're getting stuck. Where is it that what can't we get past in our mind? What is obstructing us? And so sometimes the question comes up, what is Buddhism? Is it a philosophy? Is it a religion? And really, when I think of the path to purity, I think Buddhism is a training. It's a training, the threefold training of body, speech, and mind. So when we come to this from the outset, to get our minds around the fact that this is a training, it's not a blind adherence to rites and rituals or a blind subservience to the seniority. Now, we have respect for seniority because we see, monks who have been here longer than us have more experience, so there's a natural respect that arises for those who have more experience than us. But it's a training, of body, speech, and mind. That's the path to purity. And Lungpa Cha, he would talk about how he would train people, and he was known to say in one teaching that when people first come to the monastery, he gives them candy. So when people first come, he says, yeah, I give them candy. So I kind of lure them in. And you kind of coddle them for a while, nice to them. And then once they're committed to being there, then he'll start to lay into them. So all of you who want to become Anagarikas, watch out. Not going to be easy on you anymore. We're not going to coddle you anymore. But that's good. That's the training. And everyone's different. Lungpa Cha was also one of those rare beings who saw that with these different temperaments, then everybody needs something slightly different. So the Buddha was the ultimate level of that, of being able to see each temperament and give the right teaching tailored to each temperament. Of course, we can't be at that level. We can't do that here, but Lumpur Cha would have had that to a certain extent. So thinking of this as a training of body, speech, and mind, coming to a path of purity, and the theme of the winter retreat has been back to the basics, Four Noble Truths, Noble Eightfold Path. And so when we create a foundation of those basic things, we contemplate the Four Noble Truths, we listen to teachings of Lungpa Cha, listening to these readings, suttas, and I heard that during my retreat, Ajahn Kuradhamma was reading from Great Disciples of the Buddha, so these stories of the great Savaka Arhant disciples who learned from the Buddha and trained themselves in body, speech, and mind, and the path to purity directly under the Buddha, the Savaka Arahants, Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Mahamoggallana, and so on, Angulimala, and the readings earlier in the retreat, I read Angulimala. That's good to review in our minds all of these things, and really it will help to create that foundation for ourselves. In 3 months of winter retreat is also enough time to have started to gain some experience in the practice. So having contemplated and reflected on those basic teachings, Four Noble Truths, Noble Eightfold Path, some of the biographies of the great disciples of the Buddha, teachings of Lungpa Cha, and a little bit of the biographies of some of the Krupa Ajahns perhaps have come up during the winter retreat as well, and reflecting on that, taking it in, applying it to our own practice, helping it, those things helping us to inspire ourselves. It can also help us to see where we're stuck. Even Lungpa Cha himself talking about when he started to practice, how everything, you know, in the most recent reading, when he started out, everything was either too long or too short. It wasn't right. He had to change things. His mind couldn't let go. So even somebody as great as Lungpa Cha, he's talking about those very human qualities, those places where he was stuck, and those are going to be the same places that we're stuck. Where are we stuck? Where is the mind stuck? Really looking into it, really trying to see it. And the more we apply the teachings, the more we contemplate the teachings, the more we're going to be able to see where the mind is stuck. And then we have to see it over and over and over again, because it's habitually stuck in the same places. Yeah. So 3 months is enough time to start to gain some experience and contemplating these basic teachings, then we can continue to gain experience. And there's just no shortcuts. There's no shortcuts to gaining experience. There's no shortcuts to having a lot of experience. The only way you get a lot of experience is through getting a lot of experience, just practicing for a long time. That's how we gain experience. Of course, the quality of the experience we gain is going to be different based on how we're applying the teachings. If we're veering off to the left or to the right, going down wayward paths, losing the plot, this happens to all of us. And then these winter retreats, when we listen to a lot of teachings, these are like course corrections. We if we've fallen off the path, we can get back onto the path. And there's various techniques of meditation. There's the Anapanasati, the breath meditation. There's things like metta or asubha, contemplation of the unattractive nature of bodies. All of these are techniques to help keep the mind on the path. But really, it comes down to just gaining a lot of experience. And just to think about how long have we been cultivating the mind in the opposite direction? How long have we been feeding the defilements with sumptuous, healthy food? It's going to take a while. It's going to take a while to change all those habits. Sometimes I feel quite embarrassed when I think about when I was first here. But it's good for me to recollect just because it helps me to be very, very forgiving of others who are just starting out. But I was very, very conceited. I remember writing in, I kept a journal, and I wrote in my journal, like, these people aren't practicing here. You know, all these monks aren't practicing. And I thought later, oh, if I would have met my future self when I was in Anagarika, I would have been critical of myself. That's just the critical mind. It colors everything. Critical, judgmental mind. It doesn't see things as they are. Doesn't see things accurately. Well, certain teachings are going to affect us in different ways. In 2004, Lompur Liam was visiting here, and he gave a teaching which I still remember to this day and always stuck with me. He gave a talk on the ordination platform up in the forest. And the part of his talk that stuck with me was that the mind has certain default reactions. And by the mind's default reactions or our default behaviors, we can actually know where the mind is at. And so when the mind is suffering, the default reaction is to criticize. So when we are very critical, we can actually see that rather than focus on the object of our criticism, we can turn the light around and see that, oh, that's coming from suffering. The mind that is suffering tends to be critical. The mind that is happy tends to praise. So if I get to a place, and I can see this for myself, if I'm on retreat, full of metta for the ants, then oh, everybody's great, everything's great. The retreat crew is great, the whole community's great. Love everybody. So the mind is happy, so praise occurs. Then maybe come down. So, and Ben was taking meals to me for 4 days, so I didn't see anybody. So I was very happy. Don't have to see anybody except Ben. And I wasn't critical of him. But then come down for the meal and see something. Oh, what are they doing? They didn't do this, they didn't do that. So that's all, okay, there's a little bit of suffering in the mind there. Okay, let's look at that. So always turning it back to ourselves, turning the light around. It's hard to do. It's very convincing. The mind will convince us that the problem is out there with that person. The mind is very, very convincing. And it seems so real. But actually, it's not. It's actually not real. So this teaching came up a number of times during the winter retreat that what is real? The Dhamma is real. The Dhamma is what is real. Is the quote from Lumbar Panyawato that I kind of take as a koan, although it's not a question, it's more of a statement that the khandhas exist, but they're not real. The Dhamma is real, but it doesn't exist. Taking that as kind of a contemplation. existence is defined by anicchang, defined by friction, defined by movement. So the khandhas exist. The khandhas are anicchang. The khandhas are impermanent, unstable, uncertain. The khandhas exist, but they're not real. How could it be a true reality if it's changing? The Dhamma's real. The Dhamma is the timeless reality. The Dhamma is akaliko. Each quality of the Dhamma, we can take that as a contemplation. Just the fact that the Dhamma is akaliko, taking that and that timeless reality. Can you say it exists? If it exists, you'd have to compare it to something. You'd have to define it by something. Yeah. But all you can say is it's akaliko, it's timeless. Pachatang vedi tabo vinyuhi, to be personally experienced by the wise. So the Dhamma is the reality, but we can't say it exists, not in the sense that we can say the khandhas exist, but it is the only reality. It is timeless. But taking that as a reflection, as a contemplation, things are just as they are, here and now, and it's always that way. Another one of the basic teachings is kamma, the teaching of kamma, cause and effect. And this is a pivotal teaching in Buddhism. Kamma as the second of the triple knowledge, the three knowledges that the Buddha awakened to under the Bodhi tree on the night of his enlightenment. And that was integral for seeing the end of the defilements, that realization of kamma, that all beings fare on according to their actions, whether good or bad. So as we go about our daily lives, we can start to see this for ourselves. The problem with kamma is there's a time lag, which makes it harder to see. It gets a bit more confusing. So we do have to take that part largely on faith. That's where we have faith, where we take the law of kamma on faith, say kamma and rebirth or transmigration. We take that on faith because there's other parts of the Buddhist teachings that we can see, such as kindness and generosity or qualities of development and harmony. We can take teachings like that and see the truth of them. So the parts of the Buddhist teachings we can immediately see for ourselves, then we can say, well, okay, I'll take kamma and rebirth as a working hypothesis if I can't see it for myself yet. But the more we contemplate it, kamma just will become more and more apparent. And as the law of kamma becomes more and more apparent to us, it's only natural that we will become more and more careful in our actions, body, speech, and mind. Oh, this really does have a result. Oh, this speech really does have a result. Oh, these mental actions really do have a result. They have a momentum to them. And that goes for both the good and the bad. Well, these good actions really do have good results. This good speech really does have good results. These thoughts of goodwill really do have good results, resulting in coolness, well-being, refreshment. So our actions of body, speech, and mind become very, very important. And the more we can see the law of kamma, the more we really see it, the more we really start to internalize the teachings and this, the open aiko dhamma, the internalizing of the dhamma, the more we internalize it, it's just natural that we're going to be a bit more careful. But at the beginning, we don't truly believe the law of kamma, so a lot of our actions aren't going to be in line with it. We're going to still be tripping ourselves up. It's only natural. But as time goes on, then I know this is for myself. I'd had this feeling, oh, wow. When I did that thing in the past, I didn't think it was going to have this result, and now it really has had a bad result. or that good thing I did in the past, I didn't think the result was going to be that good, but it was. So these things really do come around to us. Sometimes our good karma might come to help us when we most need it and least expect it. And bad karma might come around to hit us when we least expect it and least need it. So these basic reflections, these are very core teachings of the Buddha, but we take them all the way through, all the way on the path. And it's more about taking these teachings of the Four Noble Truths, Noble Eightfold Path, qualities of Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and we contemplate them, and then as we gain experience over the days, weeks, months, years, decades, then the meanings of these things will change for us and become more and more purified and more in line with the Buddha's true intention with all the teachings that he gave in the suttas and the Vinaya and so on. The teachings of Lumbar Cha will become much more clear. The teachings of any of the elders that we've listened to teachings from will become much more clear. And I remember telling Ajahn Kurinadama one time that, it seems like Ajahn Pasano's teachings have been really kind of changing and evolving over the years. And he said, no, I think your understanding of them has been changing and evolving. And thinking back, that actually is the case. So, oh yeah, it's my understanding that's deepening, and I can go to the suttas now, and I can read the Anguttara Nikaya, and it's almost like reading a different book from what I read 10 years ago or whenever is the last time I read through it. It's like reading a different book. Yeah, these are the same teachings, but the understanding is different. So, and in the reading, a recent reading from Lungpur Cha, also Lungpur Cha is saying, he sees people develop over the years. Sometimes people don't see themselves develop, but then Lungpur Cha, as the teacher, you say, well, I've seen you. I've seen people developing. I've seen you all getting better. Things that were tripping you up before aren't tripping you up now. So see, it does get better, but it takes time. And we're all human, so one thing that always comes up for me on retreat is these sometimes difficult memories or things I'm embarrassed about that I messed up on or did wrong as a monk over the years. But then a positive side of that reflection came up was that, well, yeah, I guess I am human. The reflection that I am human and that we're all human, so we're not robots. We can't just program ourselves to be perfect. We can't just plug ourselves. We can't plug our mind. Not yet, anyway. we can't plug our mind in to the suttas and just download them into our brain and become enlightened. Somehow, I don't think that's going to be a possibility anytime soon. Because it's through training. It's just through training that these things happen. And to keep that word in mind, yeah, I think is important. The word training. You hear it over and over again in Thailand, and that Oprom Phuk Hut means to train, to drill. That's they say it over and over again in these teachings. If you look at the teachings in Thai, they talk about when Ajahn Siripanyo was doing some translation of different Ajahns giving talks at one of these big ceremonies at Wat Bapong where they give all-night Dhamma talks. And remember Ajahn Siripanyo taking note of, he has really great translators develop shorthand when they're writing translations. And he had this abbreviation, KWP, for Kaw Wat Patipat. And he said KWP was the most common phrase in among all the Ajahns. It was by far the most common word that came up in all the Dhamma talks was Kaw Wat Patipat. And the meaning of Kaw Wat Patipat is standards of training. It means etiquette. It's standards of training, etiquette. And you see the really senior monks, that's what they're putting their emphasis on, saying, okay, there's these standards that we train by. Let's work at this. These standards of training, body and speech. Let's work at this. That's going to help train the mind. It's going to give us a sense of wholesome pride, where we feel not in terms of egotistical righteousness, but a sense of wholesome pride that we're doing something meaningful and useful with our lives. Not holding ourselves to be better than others, but having a sense of integrity and self-worth, self-confidence. Wholesome sense of self-confidence is very important to develop in the path of practice. And something that's going to help us to keep going. So we still have a little bit of time left together, another week in the winter retreat before we'll bring it to a close. So these are just some reflections by way of review and also encouragement to keep gaining experience and to keep practicing. And so I will leave it there for this evening.